This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Lisa Tucker about her novel, The Winters in Bloom. Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Hi, David. I'm great. Thanks.
Well, we're talking today on the eve of, you know, what may or may not be the big hurricane for the year. So we're both, you know, thinking about the impending storm on the East Coast. But it's nice to be able to talk to you about this novel. And which is, you know, as we're talking, it's late August. This book is coming out in early September. And
right,
so,
September 13th, right.
And probably by the time this is posted and available, it will be just around the time the book is coming out. So, but, you know, I'm interested in, you know, first a little bit about you as a writer. And just talk, maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, how you became a writer, when you started writing, and why you write, essentially.
Okay, yeah, sure. I was not a person that, you know, was writing at 4 years old and having my parents staple my books together. I kind of wish I had been, you know. I think, oh, that would have been, by now I'd be so much farther along. But I went to graduate school in English, so I was doing literary criticism. And I actually had a fellowship to do a big part of my dissertation. And I was working on my dissertation, but I also decided, and I really have no idea now why that decision was made, but I was going to try to write a short story. I think I probably thought that it would help me understand the authors that I was working on more if I'd at least once attempted to be creative, because I thought of myself as a very analytical person, which is, you know, when you're in literary criticism, that's what it is. It's all, undergraduate, I had majored in English and math, so I never considered myself a creative person. But I had an idea to write a short story, and it started out, my sister Mary Beth was a song reader, and that was going to be a short story, and that I just kept, instead of working on my dissertation, I got sort of obsessed with the story, and it grew and grew and grew, and it was eventually 800 pages long, and I was still trying to figure out, you know, how to write a story, but I was teaching myself it, because even though I knew about criticism, I really hadn't thought at all, you know, I'd never taken a class in creative writing or anything, and I was really coming at it from, you know, now a completely different angle. So it was really, I enjoyed it so much, and I felt like it was like a breathtakingly fabulous life to try to write. And I still feel that way. So, I mean, that was The Song Reader, my first novel, eventually. Like, I mean, this was in 1995, so by the time the book was published, it was 2002. So that was 7 years of dragging around my 800-page behemoth and trying to get better at writing. So, you know, that book, I wrote another book in there. I had a first agent, you know, things like that happened. But since then, I've written, you know, just kept writing, and I really feel extremely lucky that I have this life, and I unfortunately never finished my dissertation, which I do wish I'd done.
I was going to ask you about that.
Excuse me?
No, I was going to ask you about that. It's sort of the natural question. Did you, and you answered it, you never got to finish your PhD, so you're, you know, you're now kind of stuck. You have to be a writer.
Right, I know. I'm ABD, right. I know, so I was going to say, kids out there, finish your dissertations. I mean, the only reason I wish I had done it, I actually know I want to be a writer, and I know I love this in a way that, I mean, I enjoyed literary criticism, but, I mean, this is something that, you know, I think that when I teach writing, I tell people this, when you do it, if you feel like you can't stop doing it, and it's making you see the world differently, and it's making your life much richer, not because it's easy all the time, in fact, the opposite, but you know you have to do it. But I wish I'd finished my dissertation, because it'd probably be easier to get, like, a job if I needed one down the road. You never know.
Right,
it could happen. Now that I don't have a job, but, you know, another job, a real job.
Well, but it's sort of, maybe the same advice applies, that, you know, if you really don't enjoy what writing a dissertation does for you, then maybe that's telling you something about who you want to be.
Well, exactly, and I realized that at some point. I mean, a lot of people go into graduate school in English because they love books, and, you know, but then as it becomes a more narrow focus, you know, I mean, sometimes you feel a little bit estranged from your process. And so, I mean, there's no comparison. Even now when I have to write nonfiction, and I actually just wrote something that was in the New York Times on Tuesday, and I about but it was real, you know, and it's like the constraints of truth, the other kind of truth. I mean, I think fiction has a deep truth for me, and I feel like I've seen more about life from fiction, but the other kind of truth where, you know, it really has to have happened, I find that difficult now.
Well, so in terms of influences on you and the kind of writers who you think of as the, you know, the model or the hero or heroines for you, you know, who would they be?
Well, I mean, because I was a 19th century American lit, you know, I still have a picture of Herman Melville on my wall. I mean, and I loved, I've read Moby Dick 13 times. That's my claim to fame because I taught it so many times. And I love Melville. I love Hawthorne. I love Emerson. I like, you know, British stories of the 19th century. I mean, one of the things I like about 19th century literature is I think that there's a story and no one's afraid of story, and story just is obviously a part. And even though maybe thematically that's how we read it now, like we think of, you know, Ahab and nature and all this stuff, Moby Dick is still an incredible story, you know, if possibly weighted down by certain ponderous moments that I personally love. But so storytellers are the people that are my heroes, but also storytellers that, you know, have something to say, you know. I mean, in modern times, I mean, I love Mona Simpson, Russell Banks, John Dufresne, all these guys, all these people that I love, they do that. They have something to say, but they also never forget the story part. And so that's the kind of writer I think I want to be and the kind of writer I admire.
Right, those are all big story writers, I think of, you know, that I mean, they're usually big, complicated stories that take you into a really, into another place.
Right, and, like Pat Conroy, you know, it's a long book he writes, you know, but it's about, in his case, I love him because he writes about families, and so do I, and, you know, I mean, it's just, I like Thomas Pynchon, for example. I mean, I taught that, too. I was teaching, like, the literature of the quest, and I started with Edmund Spenser's Fairy Queen and ended with Crying of Lot 49, but I don't think of myself as a writer like that. You know, I mean, it's not like I'm not a modernist or postmodernist or whatever in some sense of my grasp of reality, but in my work itself, you know, I'm too much of a 19th century guy. I'm too story driven.
Right. No, and you definitely, well, let's talk about The Winters in Bloom, because I wanted to, it is a, you know, it is definitely a story, and it's about, and I don't want to, I always want to not give away too much of the story as we talk about the book, because there, we assume many people will be listening to this who have not read the book, but so we can sort of set the scene and talk about what the book is about. But it is principally about a couple of parents who have pretty, I think of as some damaged lives. A lot of baggage that got them to where they are, and they've been fortunate enough to find each other and have a great relationship. But then this terrible thing happens where their son disappears, and that's kind of the lever of the book, which kind of then allows you to tell the story. And I think I will give you praise for not meeting the expectations of me as a reader. You know, I was pretty unprepared. I mean, you sort of get more prepared as you go through, but you're really not fully prepared for the ending, which is great. So you know, you're not able to predict how it's going to end. I thought that was a good thing.
That's the kind of story I like too. If I feel really, I mean, I can watch a movie a lot, you know, a popular movie, and know, okay, the couple's going to get together at the end, and that's enjoyable. But as a writer, I would really like it where you're constantly having to rethink your expectations. I mean, I feel like that's all my books. I really try, you know, to, like, maybe you're in the head of one character and the world looks this way, and I want to put you in another place so that, you know, you have to constantly be reevaluating the world of the novel, you know, because I feel like that's really important in the real world, too.
Right, and you did mix points of view in this, throughout this book there, and I thought really interesting how, you know, in every case the families that are involved here are all suffering losses, and you're showing throughout the book how those losses have ramifications going forward to the children and the children of the children and the you know, all these, everyone is affected by those losses and those feelings that, you know, the really deep-rooted feelings of, you know, being abandoned in some way. I mean, that's definitely a theme of the book for me.
Right.
And I thought, well, now, but then the other thing that is really interesting, too, you know, and I read a little, you know, one of the things that your publicist wrote about the book I thought was really interesting, that these two main characters, is it Kira or Kyra?
Kira,
because you never know how you meant it to be pronounced. But Kira and David are both what we think of as highly protective parents, maybe to the extreme end of the spectrum. You know, we're told that you consider yourself a protective, perhaps overprotective parent as well. So, you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about how you felt. Or how you feel about that whole idea, you know, as it kind of as it is explored in the novel.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I know my publicist puts in that I'm an overprotective parent or OP mom. My son actually designated me OP mom when he was probably like 12 years old. But I mean, I was never as overprotective as these guys. Let me be clear on that. And in fact, I think it's partly because I knew I was overprotective that I worked very hard not to be. And let him have experiences that made me really nervous and try not to let him know, although obviously he did, but let him have them anyway, you know. And I mean, what I was interested in is, like a lot of novels, I take something that I feel or that I observe, and then I want to push it up a notch. I mean, I got that advice from Russell Banks, actually, at the Swanee Writers Conference, which I went to in the 90s. He said, you know, when characters act, have them overreact. And that was interesting advice because I think, you know, we are really afraid of melodrama as writers now in the, you know, 21st century. But I think that if you push people into, you know, somewhat extreme circumstances, a lot of who they are will come out, you know. I mean, it's not, I don't feel like I write those, you know, everything was fine and the family was wonderful and then this terrible thing happened like Hurricane Irene or something. I want to write everything looked fine. Because the people were holding up, you know, they were holding up their lives despite, you know, these other problems they had. So then we need a catalyst. And once we get our catalyst going, then, you know, they're going to have to go into their lives and look at them in a way that they haven't had to and really don't want to. I mean, David and Kira want to not think about the past. And I understand that because they feel like they've finally created a life that is safe, you know. They have them, as long as they keep their baby safe, and, you know, they have reasons. I think I can say this because it comes up fairly soon in the book, but when he was 2, he had meningitis, so, and that's a scene in the book that's fairly early on. So, I mean, they have very good reasons, you know, even in the current world to be afraid, I think, and I tried to understand them, but, and I wanted the reader to, too. I wanted the reader to at first go, oh, no, not, you know, people are this crazy about protecting their kid. But then, like, as we get to know them, we're like, okay, wait, like, there are reasons. And, one other thing about the missing child thing, too, I wanted this to be a book that it was clear from the beginning that it's not like Stranger Danger, which I kind of think has been overplayed in America. You know, I mean, you know what I mean? Like the sort of right around the corner could be this, you know, horrible person that's going to harm your kid. I mean, I wanted it to be clear that in this case, it's somebody they know, and that Michael, because we see Michael, we know he's not like trapped in some dungeon somewhere or something, you know? I mean, it's like who has him is the central issue, but it's not like this horrible, I hope it's not this horrible fear that, you know, he's about to be killed or something, because that's not the point of the book at all.
No, and in fact, no.
And
I think
feel that?
No. I thought you took care of that really well. I think that first of all, the statistics in I always thought about that as a parent. It is most often someone that you know in your family who's going to do that, you know, to take a kid or whatever. That's how the statistics work. You know, it is not the stranger that's really the person to be afraid of.
And of course, it's much more interesting psychologically, if it's not just some stranger, you know, because what's the psychology of that? I mean, it's much more interesting, you know, if it comes from something in the family, because then you have something to excavate with your characters.
Right, and in fact, that's really, I think, the point of the book, and what gives it depth, is that you're really, and that's what keeps me as the reader attached to them, is that it's not a thriller about how a child is lost and then found. You know, there are probably lots of books about that, and they might be really good, but what you're writing about more is, as you said, the excavation. You're trying to show how who these people are and how they got to be the people that they are through the lens of this event that's going on throughout the book. But I never felt that the issue was not the danger that the child was in, although there's always that a little bit of that fear that, you know, something inadvertent could happen, you know, thinking about you know, let's say we know who that, we don't even know who the person is who has Michael, but we know their intention is not to harm him. But you also worry throughout, there's a little tension there, something could go wrong. You don't know, you know, even though the person
That's true. I know exactly what you mean, especially as the day progresses, because it all takes place in one day.
Right.
And as the day progresses, there's a little bit of tension there, absolutely. And as a parent, you know, I mean, obviously, we're sympathetic to David and Kira, but even as a parent outside of those two, we feel like, well, if our child was actually in this position all day, we'd be really, really nervous.
Oh, my God.
You know?
No, it's unimaginable. The as any parent knows, the thing that you worry about the most is your child is not there when you go to pick her up or pick him up. You don't know where they are. I mean, that feeling, that palpable feeling of desperation and not being able to do anything. I mean, that's in part of the book, and I think pretty, you know, hard to avoid that would be, you know, this overwhelming feeling of terror and helplessness. And so you get to learn more about the characters as they go through that. They're not just hysterical, you know, and I mean, you actually treated them, I thought, pretty intelligently there, you know, so we get to learn more about who they are as characters. Then when, and you kind of diffuse that tension by allowing us to find out that, you know, they find out that he has not been taken by a stranger. It's not like a kidnapping where they'll never see him again. They have a pretty good sense at a certain point that he'll be able to be okay. But, so, you know, I think clearly the point of your book is not that event. It's what it allows you to do with your characters, and, you know, there's still tension in the story, there's still a story arc, so that we're, you know, there's an ending that brings, you know, that brings the story to a close, but I thought it was really about the exploration of loss and how that affects them and what they do to become whole people, despite the pain and the loss that they've experienced.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the way they wrote the flap copy, she wrote, my editor, I think, wrote this, you know, every marriage has three stories. Actually, that's from the book, but the husbands, the wives, and the one they create together. And the one they've created together is, you know, though overprotective, pretty good. The problem is their stories from the past. They haven't actually shared them with each other, at least beyond minor details, or let's say beyond the structure, you know, like Kira knows that David was married before. She knows there was this terrible thing that happened in his marriage, but she doesn't know much about it at all, really. And, you know, they accept that from each other. It's kind of a pact that they make that they are going to start their new life without having to really deal with that, because it is hard, you know, and I think that it feels sometimes like to have a fresh start, that's what you need, is a fresh start, like you leave the past behind and have a fresh start. But, you know, I believe, and I, you know, I think all my novels are about how it's still there, and you have to deal with it, and so that's right, that's what, and, you know, I was trying to mess with time a lot in the novel, too, like, you know, because I don't want that, it's not like a giant conversation they have all day, oh, by the way, let me tell you this thing that happened. So there's all these scenes from the past, and some of the scenes the way the order of the scenes is placed, that took me a long time structurally because I didn't want to mess up the story arc. Like you said, I wanted to keep the reader reading. Luckily, like most people find it pretty much a page turner, which is really important to me because I feel like the first job of the novelist is to keep the reader on the page. But I also wanted to, you know, back up and have scenes from both David and Kira's past, and, you know, David's mother's in there and Courtney's mother's in there, and I think there's some, you know, comic moments, especially with Courtney and her mom. We don't know who Courtney is yet, but, I mean, there are the different characters, because of the way I wanted to present them, I wanted to give the information by going through time in an unusual way, like so that sometimes a character will remember something that happened before or something long before will be placed after something. And the reason it's all kind of, it sounds more mixed up than it feels, I think, when you read it. But the idea was is that time, I mean, it was very much influenced by my T.S. Eliot poem, you know, The Four Quartets, which I love, you know, and the time present, time past, time future. I wanted to sort of mess with that in the novel, and it was really hard, actually, to figure out the order of everything, you know, so that it made sense.
Well, no, you succeeded because it did make sense, and I thought it did. It created layers of understanding for the reader. There was a couple of places I think I was confused, and maybe you intended it that some confusions to occur. I don't want to talk about the details of it because I think it gives away too much of what, you know, who the characters are and what they're doing. But I think that, you know, it wasn't confusion where I was scratching my head and you know, really getting irritated about it. It was just not knowing exactly what was going on, and I felt like it was going to be explained to me. So I was willing to go along with you in those points where I didn't quite get it. And, of course, then it made sense later as other things unfolded. So I think you succeeded in managing the various, you know, actually also many characters and many points of view, which I thought helped explain who the people were and, you know, what they were missing, too, in their own stories was told by other characters. They were missing. I thought that was really interesting, too, that, you know, there are these blind spots in their knowledge of themselves that we get to see through the lens of the other people in their family. And that was kind of...
I appreciate that. Yeah, I was trying for that. Like, there's a kind of dislocated feeling that they have, you know, because I don't think they have made peace with the past or even necessarily looked at everything. And you're right, there's things they don't know, too. Right. I would say especially Kira, but, I mean, and David also.
In a lot of ways, they reflect a kind of purposeful forgetting or ignoring. And maybe that's what they had to do in order to be healed enough as human beings to come together as a couple, because, you know, they're damaged in a lot of ways, and as you show them to be, and yet they're able to have a relationship and, you know, have a deep love that really works. So maybe in order to do that, maybe they have to forget some of their past so that they can live in the present.
I think they certainly thought so. And, you know, and that's one thing I wanted to do is try to see if they could trust each other, like, because it took a lot for them to trust each other, even though they were in love. But, you know, like, some things I think are very hard, yeah, to face yourself. And then if you can barely face it yourself, then you're not in a position to really share it, even with people you really love. And so I was interested in that, too, to watch these guys come to the realization that they had a strong enough marriage that it could take the past. And because that's something I'm really interested in, is how people recreate themselves with a really damaging past. I mean, I guess I would say all my books have to do with this. I think for me, I try to make them hopeful because I feel like the fact that people go forward and no matter what mess their own family was, they go forward and they try to have a family. And they try to learn how to be good parents if they didn't have them, say. You know, because very early on in the novel, we learn that Kira's mom left when she was 7. You know, so she doesn't have a role model. But, you know, to me, there's some optimism in the fact that, you know, life goes on and people can become much, they can have much stronger families than they had when they were children. I just love that idea.
Right. Well, it's also, it kind of breaks the kind of pop psychology view that you're doomed to repeat the family pattern. That, you know,
right.
that's not necessarily true. I've always sort of felt that was a simplification of how people are, that people do overcome. And in fact, the 19th century is a good example. If you look at how people lived in, you know, 150 to 200 years ago with really tough family lives, you know, very often there wouldn't be a parent or there wouldn't be two parents, and the kids would be growing up working from the age of six and, you know, not coming from poverty. And of course, we don't know what their emotional lives were like all the time or what their, you know, we live in a world of psychology, they didn't. But in a lot of ways, they obviously did overcome incredible emotional damage and became, we think at least, whole human beings. So it must be possible. It's not like, you know, just because your parents divorced, that's it, you're done. You know, you'll never...
Right. I know, and it's like the arc of history or something, right? I mean, we keep learning as a people, you know, what it means to be good, what it means to be a generous human being, you know, what we need to do for other people. I mean, I feel like, you know, I have an optimistic view of the arc of history, I guess. And I think that, you know, yes, things go wrong all the time, but I mean, like, I love to think about people trying to change and the struggle to be different, I think, is than your parents or than your family or than the people you know, to overcome all kinds of things that your family may have not ever had the chance to. I mean, even if they're good parents, I mean, you have, you know, different opportunities, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, every generation, I think, you know, sort of goes deeper into what we want to do to be a good parent.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that, you know, people struggle with what is the right way to be a parent and what is the right, I mean, that's what your characters are doing here. They're trying to define what is right for themselves. And of course, you know, they are, as you have them early in the book, you know, you're not quite sure whether they are really over the top or, you know, they, you know, maybe even more, maybe unable to figure that out. But I think it is, I mean, that's what makes the story, that they actually do have to go through a process and learn who they are, maybe to become better people and better parents. I think that is clearly, you know, that's a good story.
Okay.
So, you know, in terms of, I mean, since you write about family, is that, you know, you're working on another book now that will follow this one?
Well, I'm always working on something. You know, I loved to be involved in a project, you know, even if it's not necessarily going to be something that's going to work out. You know, it's hands-on, you know, you have to sit there and work. So I'm working on something now, but I'm not exactly ready to talk about it. But, you know, I think now I have six novels, which is amazing. You know, I mean, it's really strange, actually, to have that many. I mean, it feels odd to me to have that many books that I've written that are published, and then I have all the foreign editions and everything, so my little teeny house is covered in books. But I got to keep writing. I mean, I feel like, you know, as long as I can, that's a very lucky life, you know, to be able to come up with another story. But with everything, for me, it's always finding the voice. Like, that's where I feel like I'm on the way. You know, like, I was sitting on my patio, and I all of a sudden heard Michael talking about, you know, he was the only child in a house full of doubt. That was the first sentence of the book, but that's what came to me first. I don't, like, plot out in ahead of time. I just follow the voices around, you know? So I have to get a voice that I feel like I can understand well enough that I can tell their story and be faithful to them. I mean, that's really an odd kind of way to look at it, but I feel like when I'm writing, my goal is to be faithful to the characters. I don't really think about anything but that, and to be honest about what they're telling me, you know? Not push them around, like, let them breathe and tell me what happened rather than, you know, because sometimes I would like them to do something other than what they're going to do, and they go ahead and do what I would rather they didn't do anyway, you know?
Right, so you start with character and voice, and then you see what happens.
Right, and then, like, in this book, it's very complicated for me structurally, and that's why it took so long. I mean, I had the characters and the voices, everybody's blabbing, and that's good, and I'm learning things, and they're, you know, I'm very excited, but everything was, I had, like, probably 100 different files that were in different orders, you know, because I was really not sure of what the order should be. So that's what took the longest, because I don't outline or whatever. I was just trying to feel my way into the structure.
So you must have, like, an embedded sense of story in your head somewhere in order to be able to make a story work. I mean,
right, I hope so. I think it's just from, I mean, maybe people have asked me before if I think it has something to do with math, because all my stories are real structured, and probably, you know, being in math for a long time, because I also have a master's degree in math because I like school, I just hang out in school, and I taught it for a while. So it's probably, like, probably helps, but I really think the main thing is all that reading. You know, I mean, it's like when I teach writers, I'm like, just read, 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 you know, keep finding writers you like, read, even maybe type a page from a writer you like, just type it out, see how they did it, you know, and for me, like, having been a big, humongous reader and being in graduate school, but before that, majoring in English, and before that, reading, you know, I think it was great to not try, in some ways, for me, it was great to not try to write until I'd read that much.
Well, that's actually probably the same. I think that's good advice for any artist. You know, you have to suffuse yourself with the people who came before you. And it's not learning, not copying what they did or learning necessarily in a kind of, you know, a structured way what they did and how they did it. It's more absorbing it into your being so that then you know, the transformation is your own, but you've kind of absorbed all of that great art. And that's, you know, so you tell an artist to go to the museum and spend hours in front of the paintings just feeling what they are and what they do. You know, I think a lot of artists would agree that's how you become a great artist. Then, of course, you have to learn technique, but maybe you don't start with technique. Maybe you start with inspiration, which is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, and for me, like, I love so many books. I mean, you know, being in love with a book, you realize what, I mean, you get that sense. I mean, I'm reading something now. I'm always reading something. You know, I know some writers say they can't read when they're writing, and I would say that's true maybe at the very, like, last third of the book, something like that, you know, where you're just obsessed with it. You wake up, you go to sleep with it, you know. I mean, there's a point where, you know, you're dreaming about it. I mean, at that point, you don't have time to do anything except for, you know, things that you must do for your family and, you know, eat and things. But before that, I think, you know, to be always reading is, for me, it's the inspiration to write another book, is that books are so wonderful. Like, you know, I don't feel like, oh, I want to find, like, a book I don't like, and then I'll feel like, oh, I can write if they can. You know, it's the opposite. I find a book I love, and I'm blown away by, and then I just feel like I want to be part of that, you know? I mean, I know I won't be as good as them, maybe, but it doesn't matter because I get to try, too. You know, I get to be in there and doing it, too, and it's just amazing. It's an amazing thing to write.
No, that's great. I love that description, too. I think that makes, you know, I think that really resonates for, and hopefully resonates for a lot of people. Well, Lisa, it's been great talking to you. I really liked The Winters in Bloom. I've really enjoyed talking to you about it, and I wish you luck with the novel.
Thank you so much, and it's been a great conversation.
Thanks. This is David Wilk. I've been talking to Lisa Tucker about her novel, The Winters in Bloom, coming out in September. This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors.